Thank you. It's a real pleasure for me to be here and an honor. And I'd like to thank Tony for this nice introduction. I'm going to talk to you about some, this being an Institute of Theoretical Physics, of course, I have to throw in a few equations, and which I'm going to do. But this question of perceptual space is something that I've been interested in for quite a while. And in fact, this campus is home to three or four really, really good people in psychology who have done a lot of work on visual perceptual spaces, including one of them right here in the audience. So having said all of that, I'll start with some general information. One is, why even deal with a perceptual space? Is there a need for a perceptual space? Well, you know that objects in the real world have specific geometric form, they can be localized, they have certain color, brightness, and so forth. And this is somehow sensed by our eye, and we get the sense of, you know, geometric forms and so on and so forth. Now the question is the following. Here's a good example of why we need perceptual space. I mean, geometrically, we know that these two lines are parallel, right? But they seem to converge at some point. Of course, there's this, you know, a picture I took from Scientific American a while ago, but let me continue on. The first person to really talk about perceptual spaces was a mathematician at the Courant Institute at NYU, Luneberg. Luneberg also wrote a classic book on optics called The Mathematical Theory of Optics. And what he did was, Luneberg essentially took some data on binocular vision measurements done by Ogle and a bunch of others at Dartmouth, and showed how it is transformed in a brain state space, so to speak. So basically what he said was that there was a specific mapping using orthogonal coordinates, and it was ego-centered, meaning that it is something localized in you. I guess that's the easiest way to explain it. Now, the visual image undergoes a series of transformations, and we know very well, or to a very high degree of approximation, how the images displayed on the retina. That's just straightforward optics. But from the retina up to the first level of the visual cortex in the brain, we do know that there is a specific mapping that occurs. And that type of a mapping is really a conformal map. And this was done by a guy called Schwartz at NYU, another physicist from Columbia, actually. And I guess there are some Columbia folks here. And in fact, this was a classic experiment done by Roger Tuttle, Develoy, Silverman, and Switkus, where they presented a pattern like that shown on top and use some very fancy tracer techniques, 2-deoxyglucose, show that the mapping in the first visual cortex was something of that sort. And using this data, Eric Schwartz was able to show what type of a transformation it should be. So we kind of know what this transformation is, but from the visual area 1, V1, to the ultimate level at which perception occurs, we don't really know. Okay? So, we don't really know what are the relevant physiological or anatomical substrates for this, and so doing psychophysical models is a better alternative because you can try to find constraints on the system and might give you some insight into this, into how the brain is processing this visual information. And lastly, this is not new. In fact, it was known from the time of Euclid that what we see is really not what is out there. This was done by artists and others, and so, you know, in fact, in one of Euclid talks about how general geometric principles do not seem to hold in our viewing of the world around us.
The center of A is mapped onto this left-handed.
Yeah,
in
yeah,
B.
Yeah.
And on the left.
And then as you go further out, and this is just showing one part of the
So for physicists, the visual cortex can be just thought of as a plane, as a
Well, it's not really a plane, and this is a slice from the back of the visual cortex, okay? Okay. And in fact, here is a schematic for what the visual space is. Here you have physical space X, you know, you're looking out at the sea and at an island and so on. You know, physical processes, you give some kind of coordinate system in physical space, which is mapped onto a Euclidean map in visual space, and okay? This is done, this is from a paper by a gentleman called Indow, who's at UCI in cognitive sciences. And UCI hosts a really good group in mathematical psychology. And there are a lot of very good people there. And this is this is Luneberg's thing, where he takes a Cartesian space and then maps it on into what he thinks should be using polar or bipolar coordinate systems, okay? Now, having said all of this, how did Luneberg do this? He did this mapping using the data on what are called distance alleys and parallel alleys, which is you ask people to, you know, in a otherwise there are no. You have people in a completely dark room, have a set of lights, and have them arrange lights so that they appear to be parallel or equidistant and so on. These are very classic experiments in visual psychology. And using this data from distance and alley experiments, Luneberg said that visual space is a Riemannian space of constant curvature, and it had a hyperbolic geometry. And it was frameless, that there were no other cues, because if you put in other things nearby, that will affect your perception. You know, all cues to distance and depth were eliminated and so forth.
Can you elaborate on that statement about Riemannian space?
I'll be coming to it, yeah. So, overall, you can say that the properties are of a visual space was that there are three major directions which correspond to the three-dimensional world. So percepts in visual space are hierarchically related to each other. You can perceive geometric properties in the visual space. The structure of the visual space depends upon the stimulus conditions in the real world, and it's frameless in the sense that all stimuli are presented in what is called a Ganz field, which means that there are no other cues to depth, or, you know, like I said, there are no frames, so to speak. In fact, the line element in Luneberg space can be written like this, where alpha, beta, and gamma are certain sensory coordinates, and you can get a curvature. Okay? But I'm not going to talk about Riemannian space. I'm going to talk about something else that I developed a few years ago based upon experiments I did with Karen Develoy up in Berkeley. And the space was developed based upon experiments that we did over a period of a few years. And basically, we asked, how well can observers successfully make discriminations based upon relative positions of features in a given stimulus? What do I mean by that? The simplest type of thing would be, okay. The simplest would be something like this. I have a whole set. So the first one, if you look at the top, the first one was line length observations, in which you present a standard line on a plane, and you present a test line which can be a few pixels off, and it's the task of the observer to determine if the left line was greater than, longer than, or shorter than the standard. Okay? The second set of experiments were equal, which we call equal, where you have a standard and a reference, and we put a perpendicular bisector in there at some point, and observers had to determine if the ratios were the same. Then the third experiment is called profile, which had the same type of profile, but, you know, it's been scaled. And, you know, so there were a whole bunch of such experiments. Then we found that observers did very, very well in these types of experiments. So we decided, okay, we'll do something else. We'll do transformations to the stimulus. Rotate it, do up, down, and so on, or even upside down, vertical. So nothing we did seemed to throw observers off. Their performance was very, very good. And finally, what we did was, okay, what we will do is get rid of all features on the test, okay? And say that here in this gap, midpoint is where this vertical line is going to be. Is it at the, does it divide it in equal ratios or not? In the actual stimulus, there would be no arrow here. I have it here just to show where the arrow, the vertical line would have been. And or here at one end, at the edge, called it an asymmetric gap. Then, we were so frustrated that people are able to make such very precise judgments that we removed the line altogether and just put a dot in there to see if people could do such tests. Again, they did very, very well. And this was frustrating because I was hoping to find people who would fail at these tests. So any sort of transformation was allowed, except for if I had taken the test stimulus and expanded it logarithmically or something of that sort. Those are the only ones where people failed and could not make judgments. Okay, and in fact, here are some what are called psychometric functions for the 90-degree rotation, upside, and people do very, very well. And the intersector offset is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's in terms of so many pixels. Having done all of that, we found observers did very well. And in fact, one of the things you do in psychophysics is measure what is called a Weber fraction. And if you do that, the mean Weber fraction in all these different tasks, people did extremely well. OK, the Weber fraction is, let's say that I ask you to judge your length L, OK? And then change it by a small amount, delta L. What is the smallest amount, delta L, that I can notice? And the Weber fraction is delta L over L, okay? In fact, it's the same Weber we study in magnetism. So, and he's the, I guess you can call him as the father of psychophysics. So
what is this 2% line?
That was a mean of from all the data. Okay, you can compute Weber fraction for all these different experiments, and they all pretty much fell at the 2% line. So you can detect a 2% change on average, okay? So what we found, and to summarize our results, what we found was the following. Magnification, translation, inversion, reflection, rotation do not affect performance. Discrimination along one axis does not depend upon position in the perpendicular axis. Positions to be compared can be equivalently defined by any of several features, does not depend upon length ratios, but certain classes of axis transformations have little effect on performance. Like if I go Cartesian to polar, people are able to judge those in terms of resolving angles and so on, but not linear to log, okay? So having said all of this, let's say that this is you have a mapping in your retina, and it is mapped in some perceptual space. Of course, some people might even quibble about, is there a perceptual space? We'll come to that at the very end, okay? Basically what I did was I construct a model which has these constraints as an orthogonal label coordinate system. Certain transformations of scale and orientation are allowed while others are not. I take the most general form, and this is what I do. I give an affine connection like this. For any general displacement, that this f of alpha, I take it to be some function of x and y. It's an arbitrary covariant tensor. And the form of it would depend upon the characteristics of the image. OK, and I can write the connection in terms of that. And I can show that I can go through your simple tensor calculus and show that all length orthogonal transformations preserve vector lengths either in the perceptual space or in visual space. It's all pretty straightforward stuff. I can get a metric for the visual space. You can go through the calculus and end up with something of this sort. Now, you can determine the metric of the visual space because you can make estimates of length. And this constant that I have in here is some kind of scaling factor from physical space to visual space. Okay. Now comes the important thing, which is the curvature. Remember I told you that Luneberg talked about a hyperbolic geometry and so forth. If you do all of this for this particular type of visual space using the standard standard formulas, you find that the curvature tensor is equal to zero. And the Ricci tensor or the Gaussian curvature is also equal to zero. And the space is flat. Yeah.
The Riemann curvature
is flat as well as the Gaussian curvature. Yeah. Yeah. I can show you. I think the calculations are in one of my papers. I just put the result up. Why is this important? For example, in motion perception, okay, consider a rigid body moving in space. The flat curvature means that you can unambiguously compare local velocities, local velocity vectors, at even at very large separation. Okay? So which means that you can judge velocities if something is moving across, because you can judge the velocity vectors at either ends, or you can, and in this case, the parallel transport is path independent and uniquely defined, so you can judge velocities, velocity estimation. So if you have a series of neurons that are computing velocities, they could look at the orientation, do a simple parallel transport, and come out with a judgment of velocity. Okay? There are some models, the most famous of which is by Reichard, were called Reichard motion models, detectors, and this would work very well with the Reichard model. Okay? Now, we come to orientation, or orientation of vectors in such a visual space. Oh, heck, this was supposed to be a path integral. I'm sorry, it was supposed to have a sign around it, but it didn't print out. What we need to do is, you can look at, if you have a space like this and you're parallel transporting a vector around a closed path, does this kind of geometry allow parallel transport wherein the vectors come back with the same orientation? And it turns out that if you do calculate the closed loop integral, it works out to be exactly zero, meaning that vector orientations are preserved. Now, now comes a very interesting question, which is geodesics, lines in the vector space. If you do work through the algebra and you come out, you can you can write down the fact that the equation for the geodesic works out to be this, which has a simple solution, meaning straight lines. So this is a straight line in this particular perceptual space. But the straight line in this particular perceptual space need not be straight line in real space. Okay?
When you're talking about perception, is that the same as the visual cortex?
No, even further up, wherever it's, yeah.
Oh, it's higher.
Yeah,
level.
Yeah, yeah.
Because suddenly it doesn't look like straight lines in that first round.
No, it's not. Please.
How many dimensions are
working? Oh, in this case, it's very general, but it cannot be greater than 3. Okay. Yeah. No. You can define what the metric should be. Let's see. There we go. Orientation. I use the standard, I take a generalized fin connection. Okay. Excuse me? Yeah. And I, here is the, this is how I calculate the metric, and then I go through and actually show that this is going to be something similar to this. I can calculate the metric, and then from which I can use your standard equations to calculate what the curvature is going to be. Okay? Well, because I take a general form for f of x, y.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I do. Okay. Now, I've not talked about a non-Riemannian type of space yet. I'll come to that later. Okay. What? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Okay. Yeah, exactly. In fact, that's in the, you're jumping ahead, it's in the next part of my talk. Okay. So coming back to the geodesics, since geodesics in this visual space are straight line paths, this is something that might help in some of these visual illusions corresponding to, line illusions, geometric illusions. The most famous of these illusions, or one of the most famous, is the Herring illusion, as it's called. And you notice that these lines appear to be bulging out in the center. They're actually straight lines. Okay? How can I explain this result from the straight line geodesics I get in visual space? If you consider degenerate points and degenerating directions, that is, these vectors corresponding to points where the eigenvalues are equal to zero, all geodesics, if they are converging towards a degenerating direction, okay. Well, let me put it this way: if all the lines in the background, all the converging lines are converging or degenerating curves. Okay, the degenerating directions are perpendicular to those lines, but our stimuli, the two straight lines, are not perpendicular to them. So they're not along along degenerating directions, you get some kind of a perceptual distortion. Okay, this is a stretch, I admit, but it's a nice idea. Okay, so all these background radiating lines are along a degenerating direction. But the lines that you have, the stimulus lines, the straight lines, are not perpendicular to them. And it ends up with you looking as though they're not straight lines. Okay, it's a simple idea, but this might be an example or use of this kind of a space. Okay. So you get perceptual distortion. And then I also said that certain type of transformations are allowed and certain other types are not allowed. So if I can write f in terms of xy coordinates, break it down into fxx and fyy, which are the second derivatives with respect to that, I can go through a bunch of algebra and show that only certain solutions are allowed for this type of a transformation. And in fact, all the usual transformations that I talked about are allowed. But if I took a log linear transformation, which was the toughest that we tried out, it's not satisfied exactly.
What is Q?
Q is something I write in terms of the general form of f. Okay. Let's see. Perceptual distortions, I've dealt with that. So essentially what I do is I left determinant of f of the f of alpha beta be equal to zero and then solve for it. Now, this is the most important conclusions. This only defines a certain class of perceptual spaces, and the character of the perceptual space would depend upon the retinal image and transformation rules that are there. The geometry of the visual space would depend upon the characteristics of the stimulus structure. And so what I'm saying is that no simple manifold can be defined with which will describe every spatial visual pattern. But you might, at least in principle, be able to define the rule by which the pattern gives rise to a certain percept. So, and if you do know the rules, then the percepts that result from any pattern should be predictable. So I figured these visual illusions are one of the best examples of those. And I do not attach any specific meaning to any of these stimulus and so forth. But what does this mean? Here I have described a perceptual space with a zero curvature. While that was not the case with Luneburg, where he had a constant curvature throughout, and in fact, John Foley over in Psych was the first one to point out many, many years ago that the curvature, at least in the type of experimental data that he used, must be varying from point to point. Okay. Then in the mid-80s, a person called Wagner produced a model very similar to what I showed here. And he showed that if you're viewing this distance alley results and so on, you can break it down into two components. One is a component in depth, and a component in front of you. And he showed that the depth component is contracted. Okay, so if the depth component is contracted, what he showed was, based upon this, that the depth component is contracted, and Yamazaki at NTNT Research Labs in the late 90s showed that the distance alley experiments were Riemannian, while the parallel alley was not, and he used a theorem by Eisenhardt in 1927 to show that you can divide a space up into different parts where different vector fields behave differently. So he used Eisenhardt's theorem, and it produces what he calls as a torsion. Okay. But most importantly, Patrick Supps has shown that visual space is more like a physical system than a geometric system, in that it is context dependent. And he based it on the fact that your perceptual judgments of symmetry and congruency and so on affect what you perceive.
I want to come back to Jim Harrell's question.
Yeah.
Are you talking about three-dimensional space or
two-dimensional? This will be from a three-dimensional. We do a set of transformations to two dimensions. Okay.
But dual. Two-dimensional space. Everything is very simple. You still have. Are you talking about three-dimensional?
No, you're looking at the three-dimensional three-dimensional stimulus, which is then becoming two-dimensional. Okay,
is
you're full. That's what they show. Yes, yeah. But the point is, in such a, if you do introduce such a torsion, you're not going to get the same closed paths in your space. See. If the torsion component is not there, you're not going to get the same orientation of vectors when you do a closed path, so orientation is not preserved. Okay? Now the question is, where is the relevant neurobiology? I mean, there must be something that does all these computations, and that's something we don't know. Though people can look at what are called receptive fields of neurons, which is the area in physical space over which a neuron can respond to a stimulus in there, and in fact, one of the best attempts is by a mathematician at Stanford, Carlton, who has used certain descriptions of neurons, properties of neurons, to talk about mental rotation tasks and so on. So I'm going to get into that next, okay? I have time. But the most important thing that was suggested, and probably the most intriguing idea, was done was by Hoffman, who talked about a Lie transformation group approach to looking at these stimuli and how they are transformed. Okay, and if you do such a Lie transformation group thing, and you have a differentiable manifold, then it comes across as they are linked by what are called fiber bundles or vector bundles, and this is an area that no one has gone into, and there's a lot of scope for doing some interesting work in there. Now, I come to the Lie group stuff. Of course, as Tony knows, Lie groups, they have a lot of applications in optics and in vision and perception. I just mentioned it. In fact, this was the Hoffman of the Lie transformation group approach. Kaeli has shown how Lie groups can be used to extract patterns or contours from an image. And Foster has done some work on looking at apparent movement. What are the permissible paths in apparent movement? What do I mean by apparent movement? It's like this. If I have two lights, two LEDs, let's say, and I turn them on and off with a time duration, interstimulus interval between them, you will find that you will get this experience of smooth motion from one to another. In fact, you know, theater marquees and all that use them very well. And so essentially, if you, it depends upon parameters such as, what is the interstimulus interval time, how much separated they are, as well as their luminance. And they are given by what are called Cortes laws, but you do get a perceptual illusion of an actual rigid motion between two points. You know, and you can put a third point in there and show that it goes around like a triangle or, and so on and so forth. But really, really interesting work was done by Shepard, again, what he called as mental rotation experiments. And he used line drawings presented stroboscopically, 3D structures, and subjects had to determine if these stroboscopically presented objects are related by a rotation. Okay? Simple types of experiments, but like this is what he would do. Like, you know, he would first present this and then this, and subjects had to report if it was the same object that had been rotated. Okay? Or, you know, by a rotation, can you bring them both into congruency, is what you're asking. And he did this in a number of different experiments, and in depth also. And he found that as the angle of rotation increased, the time taken to determine if they were the same objects rotated by an angle also increased. And this is data from him as angle. Angle of rotation increased, the mean reaction time also increased.
Okay. I
don't know it offhand, but I can tell you what it, you know, find out the information for you. It's in that science paper. I'm sorry? Well, remember, this was in the days before computers were used to measure reaction time, so. You know, they had to press a button. So, and here are some more patterns. The essentially the psychological phenomenon of apparent motion and mental rotation of rigid bodies in a 3D Euclidean space. There's a continuous of a path of motion in your perceptual space also. And you can go through. And show that this simple thing can be written as a Euclidean group of transformations, and it preserves Euclidean distance and orientation in terms of a subgroup and a rotation subgroup, translation and rotation. This is straightforward stuff. And then you can also show that you can map them to map a rigid body motion going from point A to point B, whether real or illusory, that it has a unique path. And so essentially what you can do is you can show this path dependence and that there is a continuous mapping, and it shows the following, that you that the psychologically favored paths or motions are not arbitrary but are determined by internal constraints. That's one. And you do have geodesics of an appropriate connection on E plus that tells you something about the relative dominance and the algebraic or metric principle, straightforward. And this is what I show. Okay, connection between path, you know, some formality, there's your motion in two space, going from here to there. So you can go through the G. I'll come to as a transformation depending upon receptive fields. Okay, and your percept comes in, and that's what I'm going to show next. Okay, this is some of the results that came out and what participants suggested. And basically what they found was there was a direct proportionality of reaction times to orientation, which is consistent with continuity of imagined rotation. So essentially, people are looking at this, actually mentally rotating the object to see if it went to congruence. I'm sorry? Mostly they get it right, but it takes them longer. So that's why you see these are averaged over a number of subjects, and okay, these are the mean reaction times that are shown. Okay, so other experiments are apparent motion. Okay, let's see. So the fundamental question that any of us who do modeling need to ask are, how are these rigid transformations internally represented as a path connected to cortical patterns of activity? And the answer is there's probably a unitary representation V plus on L2, and the question is why and how?
What's the
question? The Euclidean space. Now, to give you a little bit of neurophysiology, if you look at responses of what are called simple cells, in the simple cortical cells in the visual cortex, they are spatially localized, and they have distinct excitatory and inhibitory zones, and cells would respond very strongly to specific orientations and so forth. But the nice thing is they can also be studied in the frequency domain. Okay? And there's lots of evidence, at least to a first approximation, psychophysical evidence, that the visual scene is analyzed in terms of independent spatial frequency channels. And the visual cortex acts as a spatial frequency analyzer, or does a piecewise spatial frequency analysis. And the way you describe these spatial frequency channels is by measuring their receptive fields. And here is a receptive field for a simple cell. With a symmetric simple cell, the center could be, if an object appeared in the center of your receptive field, it might be firing. And if it is appearing in the flanks, there would be inhibition. That's a simple type of receptive field characteristic that's anti-symmetric. And the nice thing is, you can represent the image in the visual cortex using both spatial and spatial frequency variables. And of course, these are some of the constraints. And one of the nicest papers is by Marcellia, where he does talk about these representations. And the most important is you can write the receptive field, which is the region in space over which a neuron can respond, in terms of simple Gabor functions. Okay? Dennis Gabor introduced these in his studies with holography. These are band-limited functions. And you can use this where you can use x and p. X is a spatial coordinate of any point in the stimulus, and p is the center of the receptive field coordinate. And you can go through in terms of a function of space and spatial frequency variables. And where P are the retinal point where receptive field is centered, X are the, like I said, the stimulus variables, and U is the perceptual spatial frequency of the object. And then you can ask, what is the interaction of F, which is the retinal image, with the receptive field profile for at any point? And you can do that, do a convolution, and go about it. And essentially, one of the important things we assume is there is some linearity, and you can show by appropriate choice of constants that the mapping is an isometry, and you can go through and show that this Hilbert space of the four variables transforms G times F is the link between cortical activity patterns and paths experienced in motion. then you can do harmonic analysis and show that you get a unitary representation of this group. And essentially, what I did and Prebrim did was write it in terms of quaternions. And in the interest of time, let me go on to the last. I got a whole bunch on properties. And you can show that it preserves the preserves a semi-direct group product. You know, do the where A and B are quaternions, it preserves identity and show all the necessary things you need to show. But most importantly, this is what you get. Okay. This is essentially what you get. So you get a succession of cortical activity patterns and you get a continuous path. So essentially you get a transformation of one cortical activity pattern to the next one, and next one, and next one, and so on, so that you complete the entire path. But there is a problem with doing some of this. So you do get a unitary action in terms of quaternion algebras, and the mapping is something like this. X goes to A times XA to minus 1 plus B. But there are problems with this type of a mapping. At least it's biologically very restrictive. Because what it means is if you do such a transform, at least one of your four parameters is fixed, which is implausible. And okay, the key is this step. Okay. So one of them. So if you just take a simple example, the 4D subspace has 1D subspace unchanged, and this is the major problem with this type of a model. Okay. This is biologically not possible, and so you need to show you know how you can remove this restriction.
Thank you. I think at this point some of us don't even know what the quaternion is supposed to represent.
Okay.
We know what a quaternion is.
Yes.
Most people in this audience.
Right. I'm sure.
What is it representing?
Okay. I want to I have this transformation, so I'm writing it in terms of a quaternion space, quaternion. Right. And then I show that it does obey all these, it does preserve translations and rotations. So anything that you have in this cortical space can be written in terms of Euclidean product group of translation rotation. Okay, that's what I'm doing. I have skipped over a whole bunch of steps in here. Yeah. It's just a way to represent in this brain state space.
The brain space.
Well, also, yeah. You know, just coordinate, just some, yeah.
Okay.
I'll come to that. Okay. So the four dimension is because remember you got the four dimensions, the where the receptive field is centered, as well as the two spatial frequencies. Okay, spatial frequencies along X and along Y in the image. Okay. Because right, and then you have the fourth one. Exactly. And I do have the four dimensions because of the two spatial variables and the two spatial frequency variables. Okay. So if you do go through this, you can show that only certain images. So if you fix one of the spatial frequencies, as it was done, as I showed you earlier, what it means is that only certain paths are possible. Okay? And it is restrictive, like I said. So you need to, so if you fix one of the spatial frequencies, you can exclude any receptive field if its frequency components are within the same tuning area. So this is the reason why this type of representation is not valid. And so what you can do is I can use a method of group extensions to get rid of this restriction. And so what I've done is I can write certain commutators like this, and where the J's are generators who give the elements of your ordinary rotation group, the P's are the generators of the translation. I can use this type of a generator. In fact, it works out to be something that most people in this room would know, a Casimir operator. And get something of this sort. And if I do that, it removes the problem that I have of one of the coordinates being fixed. And this is the type of Lie algebra that is formed. And these J and K generate an algebra isomorphic to your O3, comma 1. And the K's are representation dependent.
How did the Lorentz group come
in? Oh, because of this fact, because of the way I define my Lie algebras. So I do bring in the Lorentz group in here. This is what I do because of this. If you use a Lorentz group, it leaves a 4D length unchanged under rotation. That's why. Okay? Let's see. I'm almost out of time. So what you can do is, using the Casimir representation, and I can extend it to the Lorentz, and I can maintain the homomorphism properties that were originally postulated. But the representation is infinite dimensional, but it's still unitary. And no subspace remains unchanged by the action. Would I need to extend it or do it to higher functional dimension spaces? I do not know yet. There are ways of extending this analysis. For example, in order to get better fits of the receptive fields, I can use 6 parameters, one as an amplitude coefficient, 2 coefficients for the Gaussian spreads, 2 frequencies for the various oscillations of the Gabor, and a phase term. So I can do play around with some of this. But the important thing is, why do all of this? I mean, it's all mathematics, which is fun, and you know, if you want to sit and work through all the algebra, it's fine. But it must have some meaning in terms of real life. And in fact, I do. In fact, these are the fundamental questions I ask. The role of the Lorentz group in the context of theoretical physics is well known, but in the perceptual context, what does it mean? Secondly, if you do this, what instructions are introduced by the group for representation of visual stimuli of a neurophysiological measurement? Since technology has advanced so much with fMRIs and so on and so forth, would studies such as this tell us, you know, what are the constraints that are present, or would it predict new measurable effects? Would it help to form, you know, bridge the gaps between different domains of neuroscience? So there's a lot of opportunity for good theoretical work to be done in here.
You mean to predict experiments?
Yeah, based upon such types of group transformations and what constraints are introduced and so on. Okay, so I'll stop with this. I know I've rushed through stuff, but I wanted to cover everything in an hour.
You did it very well.
Thank you. Now I'm free to take questions or comments or criticisms. Mental rotation?
Response time is a function of angle of rotation. And the question I have is that dependent upon the vector being perpendicular to the plane of the image versus being more complex in this perceived three-dimensional space?
Well, Shepard and Metzler also did binocular experiments where depth was introduced. So I think that answers the question. And there, too, the rotations as the angle of rotation increased, the reaction times increased also. They formed a nice linear increase, or proportional increase.
Okay, I guess what I'm asking is, does the reaction time depend not only on the angle of rotation about the quaternion vector, but does it in fact depend on the quaternion vector itself? Because I would imagine if you take a simple rotation in the plane of the image, compare that to a flip and other more complex
That's probably true, but I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if those were studied. Do you guys know?
And the idea that there's not just a dependence on the difference in the difference between the angles, but
no, but also some some flipping translation.
I don't know about those stimuli, but obviously for things like faces, it would make a huge difference if you're given a face that's like sideways and one that's
right.
Upright. versus one that's sideways and one that's upside down. That'd be much harder, and the difference is the same, 90 degrees.
Right.
So, but yeah.
I think the rotation in the image plane is about the same. Yeah, I think that's probably right.
I think they're pretty much the same for the different axes of rotation.
But the thing is, it's not talking about just simple rotations, but it's also talking about rotations where you flip it, like your example of faces being 90 degree rotations and so on. So I don't think they did those in those days.
Well, they did different axes of rotation that were fixed, so they had rotation around the image plane or.
Out of the plane? Did they? I think they did. Yeah. Right. And there were no cues or anything of that sort. As I showed you, they were like made up of building blocks. So, yeah. And they also used random stimuli, too. So.
Question?
Yeah.
So, why are there 4 parameters biologically impossible?
No, because if you not for 4 parameters are biologically impossible. If you go through the original formulation, what happens is one of the 4 parameters is left invariant. It is fixed. Okay. So if you have 2 spatial frequencies and 2 spatial coordinates, one of them is kept fixed. And if one of them is kept fixed, that means that you are restricting all the allowed paths that are possible. Okay. Excuse me?
Why is it kept in the group representation, or is it kept in the brain?
Well, from the group representation, this is the knowledge that, this is the conclusion that you draw. Okay, so one of the 4 will have to be fixed. It does not change. Okay, so if you apply this rotation. So which means that only certain paths are allowed or not, and some others are not allowed. Only certain trajectories would be allowed. This way. Okay? That is what I'm saying. So this is not the right formulation. Okay? And in fact, I think in one of my overheads, I did show what these trajectories might be.
Different question.
Yeah.
I was very disturbed when you told me that the glaucoma test that we guy on iBuck is blue on the smallest worthless.
No, I didn't say that. I said.
In fact, they see a pressure difference. Oxygen is already there.
Yes.
Yeah, so why are we still going to those glaucoma tests?
Yeah. No, you see, by the time the pressure, the intraocular pressure is quite high, the optic nerve is already damaged. That's what I said. Well, actually, there are some folks who are doing some newer tests. For example, there are 3 classes of cones, and there's something called the short wavelength sensitive cones or blue cones. They seem to be affected very, very early in glaucoma. So people now do perimetry, which is measuring the visual field using blue stimuli, short wavelength stimuli. In fact, that's been showing some very encouraging results. It's called short wavelength perimetry or something.
So this is a new kind of test.
Yes, this is a new test.
Yeah.
I don't think it's on the market. Do you know anyone know? No, I don't think so. I know Chris Johnson up in Oregon has been one of the major inventors of this technique, and short wavelength sensitive perimetry has been used in a number of other disorders. The short wavelength cones, for some reason, seem to be very, very susceptible to damage very early. Yeah. Hold on. I'm still trying to find my.
Okay. So for us, for those of us that are not that sophisticated in math, can you give us a tangible example of what would be a prediction, given that you've shown this Lawrence group? What kind of an empirical prediction about whether it's something to do with behavioral experiment or in terms of what you were discussing, neural imaging?
You want the real answer? I don't know. Okay. Because some of these, you see, I mean, there have been only a few attempts at trying to do group theory to try to understand perception. There are not very many people around who do this. And in fact, to me, this was all mathematics, okay? By stretching it, you know, I can talk about maybe these illusions are due to degenerating points and so on. But in terms of mental rotation, I really don't know, you know, what the implications are. This is just the first step, okay? But people have used such Lie group algebras to look at image processing. In fact, there's considerable literature in the computer vision field where people have used such group theoretical approaches. Okay. But no one has really looked into them in terms of human perception. But the thing is, you do have to bring in, you see, it's anything that you know we theorize has to have, maybe some people in this audience will disagree with me, has to have some basis in physical reality, which means that we must be able to do experiments to, you know, to verify if your experiments are, if your theory is right or wrong. So the implications of some of this, we, you know, I really do not know. In fact, I started doing them only a few years ago, and it's been a lot of fun, but there aren't very many vision people I can talk to about this. You know, so. Anything else? That's okay. I can my overheads will be here where I work them out in detail. So.
That was appropriate for the like the lower level circuits to like for example the hypercolumns and the striate complex and those parts of your visual cortex. But the time scales that you're getting for the rotation solutions to these rotation problems seemed like it was actually done in more in your higher consciousness. So I don't see there being a relevance.
No. Remember at the very beginning. What I said, we do know the transformation properties from the retina to the cortex, but from there to wherever it goes, we don't know. Okay, so I'm not talking about these orientation hypercolumns and so on and so forth. This is somewhere.
Thank you.
I can't find.